Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Sitalia. We continue our series on alternative energy with a look at biodiesel, the clean-burning, non-toxic fuel made mostly from vegetable oil. But first, back in 1951, the radio pioneer Edward R. Murrow launched a unique radio program where Americans from all walks of life shared the values and beliefs that guided their daily lives. The show, This I Believe, brought comfort and inspiration to a country worried about the Cold War and McCarthyism. In 2005, This I Believe was revived on National Public Radio, and this year, WPSU launched a local version. Take note, Cynthia Berger talks with the series producer of This I Believe, Dan Gettiman, about what it's like to manage this unusual nationwide project.
Dan Gettiman joins us from the studios of member station WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Take us back in time and tell us where the original idea for This I Believe comes from. The show that everyone knows now on NPR is actually based on a show from the 1950s.
Its origins go way back to 1949. There was a luncheon between Edward R. Murrow, the great radio broadcaster, William S. Paley, who was the founder and president of CBS Radio and eventually CBS Television, a man named Ward Wheelock, who was an advertising tycoon, and actually right up the road, general manager of the CBS affiliate in Philadelphia. And the four of them got together and basically bemoaned the state of the American soul. And they felt that America was going to hell in a handbasket, that material values were reigning supreme, and that there were no spiritual values or ethics or anything. It was all about making a buck and buying your house out in the suburbs. And they felt that somehow they needed to do something to edify the American public. So they came up with this idea of getting a whole bunch of prominent people, Nobel laureates, movie stars, ex-presidents and Supreme Court justices, etc., to talk about what were the bedrock values of their lives. And the goal was overtly to sort of raise the awareness of the American public as far as its spiritual values.
Now, but you were mentioning in describing the show that that they invited famous people to contribute their essays. I think a really interesting thing about the original This I Believe was that it really got popular after they put real people on the show.
That's right. Shortly after they started airing these famous people, they got a letter from a housewife in North Carolina, I believe, who basically said, "This is all well and good, but I can't relate to these people. They're not like me. You should have people like me on." And they said, "Okay, let's have you on." And she was the very first non-prominent essayist. And they started to look around themselves and who were the people in their lives who might have something interesting to say. So some of the staff members had their barber on, or their dentist, or the cab driver that took them to the airport, or their kid's teacher at school. And each time a different person came into the studio to read their essay, they would ask them, "Who are four or five other interesting people in your orbit that you think we should invite to write one of these?" And they were all done by invitation. They were all solicited. What we've done differently, I'm jumping ahead, but is, of course, every week on NPR, we ask everyone to write their own essay. And indeed, on your program today, we're asking your listeners to write their own essay. And so ours is perhaps a bit more of a populist endeavor than what they did back in the 1950s.
But still kind of a revolutionary idea. I mean, we kind of take it for granted now that you'll hear ordinary people's voices on public radio, but that was really an unusual idea then.
To the best of my knowledge, this was the first time that was done on television or radio. There was no such thing as user-generated content in the 1950s. The only time you would hear from a regular Joe or Jane Doe would be if they were a newsmaker. Otherwise, they were really largely invisible. So this was indeed a revolutionary idea and was way ahead of its time in many respects. In some ways, I consider it the first public radio show because it accepted no outside advertising. It was completely funded by grants, or a grant from one of the original participants, this advertising tycoon I mentioned, who was from Philadelphia as well, Ward Wheelock. Actually, this whole thing originated in Pennsylvania, I should note. And it debuted on the CBS affiliate in Philadelphia. And it was a local program for its first 3 months. And all of the people who were involved with it, other than Murrow himself, were all from Pennsylvania.
Let's talk about the modern version of this, I believe, launched in 2005 on National Public Radio. And I think fans must think you have a very cool job as executive producer. Tell us the story of how you were inspired to revive the series. This is kind of one of those serendipity stories.
It is indeed, and one I'm very grateful to have had happened to me. I was homesick with the flu almost exactly 5 years ago. And I was actually out of work. I was had been laid off from one job and hadn't done any public radio in several years. I had sort of semi-retired. And I was looking for something to read, and my wife had a secondhand copy of a book that had been a bestseller in the 1950s, which anthologized these This I Believe essays that Edward R. Murrow had hosted. And I started reading this book, and I was really struck by its oddly contemporary nature. I immediately drew all these parallels between what was going on in America in the early 1950s and what was going on in America in the early 21st century. We were about to launch an unpopular war abroad. Civil liberties were being curtailed. Back then it was because of fear of the Russians and communism. And of course, in 2003, it was fear of terrorism. And so they were dealing with their own civil liberties issues. People were afraid to speak their mind. People were, you know, there was surveillance. And if you will recall, everybody was up in arms that the authorities were able to know what books you were taking out of the library and what videos you were checking out of the local Blockbuster. And so somehow to read these essays from 50 years before, where people were struggling with all the same things, is this kind of behavior American? Is this right? What should we do when our government is doing unpleasant things? What's the nature of dissent? I mean, it's just all these very interesting and very contemporary things. And also, the thing I was really struck by about the 1950s essays is how real they were. These were people who were largely really letting their hair down in public. One of the early participants, who was kind of like the Norman Schwarzkopf of his era in the Korean War, he likened it to taking your clothes off in public. And it was a very unusual thing. There really wasn't much like it at that time in media. So I was really struck by this, and my thought was, could this work again on public radio? And with the advent of the internet, it would allow more and more people to be participants and more ways for the essays written by those participants to be disseminated. And indeed, right now, one of the hallmarks of our project is that every single essay, and we're nearly up to 50,000 essays that have been submitted so far, are all available on our website at thisibelieve.org, including many essays from folks right there in central Pennsylvania.
You mentioned you've gotten 50,000 essays, and you can only broadcast a handful, one each week every
yes.
year. I know the website has handy tips for writing a successful essay. Our listeners want to know, give us the inside scoop. When you start reading an essay, what makes your heart beat faster? What makes your hair stand on end?
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess that, to thine own self be true. You know, it's those people who are speaking from their heart, if you will, about things that really matter to them, and try not to edit themselves too much, try to be, I don't know how else to say it, as real as possible. That counts for a lot. There are a lot of factors involved with which essays we pick to air on NPR, and some of them have nothing to do with the quality of the essays. For instance, let's say that we just aired 2 weeks ago an essay from a cancer survivor. Well, it's highly unlikely that we would air another essay from another cancer survivor anytime soon. And maybe in the interim, we might get 15 terrific essays written by various people who have survived various kinds of cancer. So we probably wouldn't air any of those, even though they were terrific, well-written, well thought out, and deeply moving.
So going for a variety of content and geographic diversity, diversity of voices?
Yes, all of the above. Mm-hmm. We're trying very hard to get more young people to get their essays on the air. Of the nearly 50,000 we've taken in so far, something like 30% of them are all from people under 18.
That raises an interesting point. One thing that's really cool here in central Pennsylvania is that a lot of our local schools use this, I believe, as a classroom writing exercise. Is that pretty common in other places, do you know? Do other schools using it?
It is. It's actually been the thing that has most been exciting about our project that we weren't planning for at all, and that is that to our knowledge, it is being used in tens of thousands of schools and school systems around the country. In some cases, it's the whole school system from elementary school to high school. In some cases, in many cases, it's all the high schools or all the middle schools and all the high schools. It's being used in hundreds of colleges and universities. So people have done any number of things with this in the schools throughout the country.
Here at WPSU, we produce a local version of this, I believe, and we often see that when someone's essay is selected for the show, they're a little nervous about coming into the studio to actually read it out loud into the microphone. How do you make people comfortable with the recording process?
Well, actually, the recordings are overseen by my colleague Jay Allison, but I have been in on some of those sessions. And one of the things he does, he has people do calisthenics, jumping jacks.
Oh, that's funny.
He's a former theatrical director, and he has them do a variety of vocalizing exercises, you know, I, E, A, E, U, those kinds of things. And so by physically limbering themselves up, by exercising their mouths, sometimes he has them sing and do other goofy things, it relaxes them, and when they finally read their essay, it can be more natural and less read.
Some of my favorite essays are the slightly wacky ones, like The Guy Who Believes in Barbecue, or the essay we recently broadcast by a Penn State commencement speaker who uses pastrami as a metaphor for well-lived life. Do you have a favorite essay or a favorite kind of essay?
Oh, boy, that's such a tough question. It's sort of like saying, which of your kids is your favorite? I love one essay by a woman named Mary Cook from Gustavus, Alaska, that we broadcast in our first year. And her story is basically that she was engaged to be married to a man, and he died suddenly. And the entirety of this tiny little village in Alaska embraced her and did everything for her. And she basically writes about, you know, her belief in sort of the power of the community. And it's just a beautiful story. And when it aired, most of the people in that town were gathered in her home, and many of them got in bed with her to listen to this on the radio while it was airing. So I just love everything about that story, and I've had the opportunity to meet the woman. She spoke at a live event we did in Seattle, and so that one is very dear to me.
So, Dan Gettleman, what do you believe? If your essay were going to be on the show, what would it be about?
Oh, boy. I have not formally written my essay. I've written kind of a first draft of it. And basically what I've come down to is I believe in the actions of love, if you will. Meaning it's not enough to say you love someone or actually, in fact, love them, but the importance of showing it with your actions. And it's very hard to do, especially in a family setting. And when it is done well, it is truly heartwarming.
Well, Dan Gettleman, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dan Gettleman is the executive producer of the This I Believe series on National Public Radio. WPSU just launched a local version of the program this spring. For more information, visit our website at wpsu.org/believe.
You are listening to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. We continue our series on alternative energy with a look at biodiesel. Interest in the clean-burning, non-toxic fuel made mostly from vegetable oil that's grown in the United States is exploding. We'll find out how researchers at Penn State and elsewhere are applying the tools of modern molecular biology to access the energy stored in the cell walls of plants. Let's take note with Tom Richard. He is Associate Professor of Agricultural and Biological Engineering and Director of the Penn State Institutes of Energy and the Environment. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Everyone seems to compare biodiesel to ethanol, although they're very different. What is biodiesel?
Biodiesel is a fuel that can go into diesel engines, and it's produced from oils, mostly vegetable oils, that have been converted into a slightly different chemical form so it can burn in conventional diesel engines.
Now, much of the biodiesel today is made from soybean oil. What makes soybean, currently at least, the preferred feedstock for processing into biodiesel?
Well, the main reason we use soybean oil is we have a lot of it in the United States. The soybeans are produced primarily for livestock feed, and the process of converting them into a feed includes pressing out the oil, which can be used as a vegetable oil, but also can be converted into fuel.
Now, it's touted as for its superior lubrication qualities. It's also touted for being highly biodegradable. What are other benefits of biodiesel, and why the big movement toward it?
Well, some of the other benefits are the relatively low emissions of biodiesel, so particulate emissions as other emissions that are air pollutants. There's also the renewable energy factor, and biodiesel is one of the most efficient conversion processes to get renewable fuel. It's taking advantage of existing crops that we have, and it's not competing as directly with the food system because we still have the soybean meal once we've pressed the oil out of the bean.
Now, you're doing a lot of research on biofuels here at Penn State, and you have organized your work around the concept of fields to wheels. Explain that and really what kinds of work you're doing here.
Well, Penn State has people doing bioenergy research in a whole bunch of different areas, and it's an integrated system, and it reflects the integration of the fuel production system, where you start out growing plants in fields, go through various conversion technologies, and then produce products, many of which go into transportation. There are the wheels, but also can be used for heat and power and electricity production.
Diesel fuel is often referred to as the industrial fuel of our nation. Truckers use 56% of the diesel that's used in this country. How receptive are they to filling up their tanks with biodiesel?
Well, many of them are using it very, very much, very positively, and some have had some problems. One of the interesting things is in the last few years, as the biodiesel industry has grown, we've also had a switch from conventional fuels to a low-sulfur diesel. And in that switch, we started to find that the low-sulfur diesels had some problems with cold weather performance. Biodiesel is typically blended with conventional diesel. And some of the truckers, particularly in the northern parts of the U.S., have had some problems over the last couple of winters that they've blamed on the biodiesel part of the blend, when it turns out it's more likely part of the sulfur, low-sulfur part of the diesel. So there's been some resistance there. The other challenge has been not all the biodiesel producers are meeting the ASTM standards for the fuel. And so there's been some poor quality material that's gotten on the market, and that's clogged some fuel filters and caused some problems. So the industry is working very hard to try to maintain high quality and to work out some of these challenges so that it can be a reliable and very positive fuel.
Now, biodiesel, as you said, is mostly mixed. Most people are using it as a blend. But here at Penn State, you're working on something that's attracting worldwide attention, and that is using 100% biodiesel in three New Holland agricultural tractors. How's that going?
Well, it's going quite well. And Glenn Kaufman, who heads our farm services operation, is doing a great job with working with the New Holland company to try to test out this material at 100%. Now, New Holland and other equipment manufacturers are very interested in using higher quantities of this, but they wanted to make sure there weren't going to be any problems down the road. So we're working with those, keeping very close track of maintenance. The engines are going to be torn down after a year or two, and we'll just make sure that as these high-quality fuels are used, that there aren't any problems at 100%.
Now, lots of people think of biodiesel as an experimental fuel, but in fact, it's really been pretty well tested. Some of the early adopters have been governments, federal and local governments, and the Navy has been a big early adopter.
Of course, there are a number of benefits to biodiesel, and one of them is the national security concern, that there's an energy security opportunity here. So the military is very interested in that. Governments are creating policies and incentives to use more of these renewable fuels that substitute for petroleum. They've had good experiences by and large, and by working with large fleets like those organizations have, we're able to get the experience that can convince other large fuel purchasers to use this material as well.
Now, in the United States, something like 20% to 30% of crops grown in the United States are grown for biofuels. In Germany, there's also quite a lot, although in Europe, overall, it's only about 2%. But there seems to be a bit of a backlash in Germany, where some people are complaining that there's sort of this biofuel insanity, where growing fuels or growing crops for biofuels is edging out forests and wetlands, and it's driving up costs for food and even availability of food. How concerned are you about that?
Well, I think these are concerns we have to explore and really understand. Now, the drive up in food prices over the last year has had many different factors, one of which is the price of conventional fuel, which is an important input to agriculture production and transportation and processing. So to the extent that we're substituting for some of that conventional fuel, we might be holding down some of those parts of the price increase with biofuels. The other factor, though, is that we live in a world of climate change. And last year we had major crop failures in Australia and other parts of the world, and that's driven up the price of rice and wheat. So it's really a difficult system to understand what the best solutions for, but we need to think about those questions carefully. One of the things that I think we have to recognize as a society is we live in a very different world than we did 2 or 5 years ago, where we now understand there are limits to what we can do, and some of our consumption patterns are not sustainable in the long term.
So conservation is going to play a role no matter what we do.
That's absolutely right. And we have to then think about our other resources, and land and agriculture is one of them, and what is the most important thing we can get from that land. And a lot of our work here at Penn State is trying to find ways that we can actually produce fuels and food from the same land in environmentally sound fashions. For example, one of the things that Greg Roth has done a lot of exciting work with over the last few years is using winter oilseed crops like canola, which can grow in our climate in between corn and soybeans, our major summer crops, and take advantage of the sunlight that's falling on the ground in the fall, in the winter, in the spring, take advantage of some of those nutrients that would otherwise leach into our water systems and cause water quality problems, and instead of having those environmental detriments, actually have benefits of the fuel and a better environment as well.
Now, you mentioned canola oil. That's a rapeseed oil. What about others such as palm oil or mustard seed, or what even about animal fat? What role might they play in biodiesel?
Well, great question. One of the things that we also have to think through is how do these crops fit into the environment, and what are the implications? Now, you mentioned animal fats, and they and waste oil and greases from restaurants are huge opportunities. And those materials, we should be using it to greater advantages, and biofuels is a great option. I mentioned the fact that we can grow some of these oil seeds on the same land that we grow our other crops on and not compete directly against food. And mustards are another one that we can do that, and there are some others in that family. You mentioned palm oil, and there are some complications. It looks like there's some pressure on rainforests to produce more palm plantations in other parts of the world. And cutting down those rainforests and the carbon implications of that for global warming are really not very pretty. So some studies indicate that it might take decades to actually reclaim the carbon debt that's caused by that land conversion.
Lots of people talk about the energy that's required to convert corn into ethanol. How does that compare with biodiesel? How much energy goes into the processing of that fuel?
Well, biodiesel is a much more energy efficient conversion process, and the soybeans are actually easier to grow as well. So the combination means that you go from a situation with corn ethanol where you might be getting about 30 or 40% more energy out of the system than you had to put in terms of fossil fuel, to with biodiesel getting 3 to 5 times as much biofuel out as the fossil fuel required to make that fuel.
There's been a lot of government support in the form of subsidies for ethanol. Are we going to start to see more of that for biodiesel made from things like soybean and canola oil?
Well, we actually already do, although I think there's opportunities for improvement there. Pennsylvania, our legislature is right now looking at some major energy policies that will actually provide some additional incentives in our state for biodiesel production. There are some big opportunities there that we'll see how they explore.
I think one of the big questions is, how does this biodiesel stack up against conventional petroleum-based diesel in terms of miles per gallon and just how well your vehicle runs?
Sure. Well, I mentioned earlier the improved lubricity, and we talked a little bit about that. That's the good side. The downside is biodiesel has got a little bit less energy density, similar to ethanol in that respect. It's not quite as big a difference, but about 10% less energy in a gallon of biodiesel as there was in a gallon of conventional diesel. it turns out that the combination of less energy per gallon, but also better lubricating characteristics and less frictional losses in your engine, mean that the mileage penalty you pay for biodiesel is very small, typically about just 2%. And so that's something that most people wouldn't notice. And, of course, the benefits of cleaner air and reduced emissions, we think, more than compensate for that.
You mentioned earlier that there are some problems with cold weather. Another obstacle seems to be its shorter shelf life. This stuff goes bad.
That's right. It does degrade. Oxygen gets into the fuel, and it essentially turns rancid. So we want to prevent that. And Joe Perez in our chemical engineering department has developed a lot of oxygen stabilizers that can actually be added to the fuel and make it last longer. However, you don't want to leave this fuel sitting in your tank for a year or more. In fact, a few months is probably good. And so having that turnover is an important part of using biodiesel effectively.
Now, most of us can't go to the pump and pump this into our tanks, but lots of people, innovative people, are figuring out how to make it themselves and are fueling their homes or their automobiles this way. How easy is it, or how difficult is it, to make this stuff?
Well, the basic process is relatively easy. It can be done in a tank. You need to stir up the material and mix it with an alcohol, typically methanol, and then add a catalyst to make the conversion process. And then you separate out the fuel from your glycerol with a water-based washing system. So there are kits that people sell, and you can do it pretty much on your own. I've seen conversions of hot water tanks. But there are some issues associated with that, and particularly that alcohol methanol that's used as part of the fuel. That's a very toxic compound. It's a hazardous material that needs to be controlled. If you're breathing the vapors or getting them in your eyes, you can cause some very important health problems. One of the things we've been doing at Penn State is providing some educational materials and a brochure that's about to come out to help people that do want to make biodiesel do it safely.
All right. We've been talking with the director of the Penn State Institutes of Energy and the Environment. He's also a professor of agricultural and biological engineering. Tom Richard, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Patty.
For Take Note, I'm Patty Satalia.
Podcasts of this program are available at WPSU.org. This has been a production of Penn State Public Broadcasting.